Welcome back to Backbone Radio. Your host, Ross Kaminsky. Behind the glass, Joshua Scharf. I'm joined in studio by Kathleen LaCrone. Before we get to a discussion of the census, I want to just finish up this conversation we were having about Christmas versus Easter. And before we went to break, basically, sort of tag team here of Joshua and I made the point that the definitional holiday of Judaism is Passover, in the sense of the holiday that defines Jews as a people, having gotten out of Egypt and so on. But the most important holiday in Judaism is Yom Kippur, and that's understandable in the sense of, theoretically, that's a holiday where you ask to be allowed to live for another year. So within Christianity, the definitional holiday, as you would describe it, would be Easter, as you did describe it. Mm-hmm. But people celebrate, and use that word literally, because you don't really celebrate Yom Kippur, celebrate Christmas. So how is it that the more celebrated holiday is the one that's not the definitional one, is because birth is more fun than death?
Absolutely. And no one wants to suffer. I mean, that's what Maundy Thursday and Good Friday, it's the suffering. And it's the same thing with what you're saying with Yom Kippur. It's the idea that you're seeing something suffer. You yourself are having to suffer. And Easter is watching Christ suffer through his death, those that mourned with him, the persecution that ended up afterwards for the Christian faith. You know, the whole idea of what that means then to follow Christ is to die to self. And so no one wants to do that. That's the whole struggle that we have with our flesh. And so why would you want to celebrate Easter? So for the Christian faith, we celebrate the birth of Christ more fervently just because of that. Although those that are true to their faith know that in reality, the birth of Christ could not then follow the death of Christ, but we have to celebrate his death more fervently, because without that death of the cross, then our faith would be empty. So it's the same idea of what Yom Kippur is, I think, that no one wants to celebrate, you know, suffering.
So, you know, another thing that comes up, I think, between Jews and Christians alike this time of year, I mean, we have Hanukkah this time of year, which is probably the least religious in terms of where it came from, one of the least religious Jewish holidays. It surrounds a historical event much later than most biblical events, where some soldiers found some oil that lasted for 8 days in their oil lamps, when there was only supposed to be enough for a few hours or a day, something like that. And somehow both Christmas and Hanukkah, and since the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar, it falls different days each year, both of those have turned into massive retail enterprises.
Yes.
And you know, a lot of people across religions, you know, don't love that idea. You know, what's your take, and what do you think more generally is the take of you know, committed Christians such as yourself to the retail aspects of Christmas?
Well, I think in spite of the bad economy, one good thing that comes out of it is that people then go back and say, hey, we don't need to commercialize it any more than it already is. And so especially this year, I saw people not giving to their own family members, but seeking out. Our church, in fact, has a project called the 1 Hour Mission Trip, where we go and we, as groups or individuals or families, adopt a family, and we spend an hour shopping for that family and then an hour giving that family gifts on behalf of the church and on behalf of our faith, saying that it's not about the gift giving, it's the gift receiving, and the generosity that comes from a life that is lived with Christ. So I think that is the commercialism that we're trying to come now. It's not saying don't buy for me or my family, but let me buy for those that are less fortunate and spread that joy that Christ brings. So, you know, I think that's the antidote, I guess, to the commercialism for the buy, 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 me, is to say, no, let's buy for others. And in turn, still have that gift giving and generosity, but give to those that are less fortunate.
Well, that project of your church sounds fantastic.
It is.
Extremely worthy of this time of year.
Well, people always talk about mission trips, and they think about going to far overseas and all of this stuff. But, you know, Christ commands us in the last chapter of of Matthew that, you know, we need to have Judea, Samaria, and the outer ends of the earth. And so we talk about, well, what is your family? Then what is your community? Then what is your state? And then what is your country? And then your world. And that's how evangelism happens. But that's also how we spread, you know, spread the gospel and also have our family know that we don't have to be a missionary to China. You can be a one-hour mission trip to the family down the street that needs some food.
Wow. Well, that's a great project. Yeah. And so on behalf of everyone, thank you and your and your co-religionists for doing that work.
Religionists, hey!
I didn't mean that as a negative.
I know you didn't.
What should I have said?
Fellow Christians?
Well, but it's not that specific. It's more specific than that. It's not every Christian that's doing that.
No, you're right. It's the parishioners of our church.
Yeah.
I guess parishioners is the right word. So yes, no, I didn't mean all to chastise you in any way. I didn't mean to chastise you.
So, okay. We've done our religion for the evening. Always extremely difficult to
check
do.
Check that off your list. Are you Ross?
No, I actually think it's really interesting. Joshua has a thought on this.
Yeah, no, just in terms of Ross's comment on co-religionists. I have a copy of the 1911 Britannica where talking about Disraeli, they talk about how his father was born into the Jewish confession. So, we all yes. get these things off-key.
Your confessional tradition, is that's a perfectly serviceable term for which faith you're a member of. So, Kathleen, I know you have been just itching to get to the subject of the census.
Oh, I don't know about itching, but I just think I think the census is very interesting, especially being a longtime native, not just me, obviously, I've lived here my entire life, but also my family, my mom's family, generations go back to being a Colorado native, and how Colorado has changed. I can remember as a child having one of the census years and hearing that Colorado's grown to 3 million, and we've been overrun by the Californians. We're, you know, everybody moved to Montana. There's 3 million people, and now Colorado is over 5 million people, and that's just an amazing thing to me to think that we are over 5 million now.
So one of the few things that our federal government does that it's actually supposed to do, because most of what it does is not supposed to do, but one of the things it's supposed to do, straight out of the Constitution, is the census. It does it every 10 years, and then basically what happens is that based on the population, seats in the House of Representatives are apportioned out to the states. And so what's happened in this year, I'll just give you the rundown. This year, Texas gained 4 seats, which is fairly enormous. We'll talk about the political implications of all of this in a couple of minutes here. So Texas picked up 4 seats. Florida picked up 2. And then Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, South Carolina, Utah, and Washington each picked up 1 seat. Just to be clear, that's Washington State, since Washington, D.C. is not a state and does not have voting members of the House of Representatives. And losing seats, New York and Ohio lose 2 seats each. And then losing 1 seat each are Illinois, Iowa, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, Missouri, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. And what I would point out about those states, you can kind of set aside Louisiana. Louisiana lost population because of Hurricane Katrina, and they had a lot of people move out of state. In particular, a lot of them moved to Texas, which could have actually increased with Texas getting 4 seats. It's possible that one or more of those 4 seats are actually based on people who used to live in Louisiana. But if you think about these states, New York, Ohio, Illinois, Iowa, Massachusetts, Michigan, Missouri, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. I mean, one thing sticks out in my mind. What about you, Kathleen?
Well,
what?
I think they're a little on the blue side. What do you think?
They're a little on the blue side.
Yeah, in more ways than one. They're sad they've lost half their population.
They're losing population. They have terrible budget deficits,
yeah,
huge budget problems, and they've been run by Democrats for a long time.
Entrenched.
You know, Ohio's, you know, kind of swings back and forth in terms of who's got the governorship. And it's, you know, it's kind of a mixed state. But boy, New York, Illinois, Massachusetts, Michigan, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. I mean, that is blue America, and these states are losing seats. You look at the seats that gained the states that gained the seats. Texas picked up four again. Florida picked up two, and I'll read them again: Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, South Carolina, Utah, and Washington. Basically, Republican states. But there's going to be some very interesting politics involved. We're going to talk about all of that, including whether it will help the GOP as much as some people think, when we come right back after this break on Backbone Radio. Stay with us.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons.
Welcome back to Backbone Radio. Ross Kaminsky with Kathleen the Crone in studio. Joshua Scharf behind the glass. You can join the conversation 303-696-1971, as Francile did with the correct answer to my trivia question.
Yes.
And or you can shoot me an email, ross@backboneradio.net. And Joshua is joshua@backboneradio.net. He's very, very pleased to have a new email address. We were talking about the census before we went to the break. And while we were off the air, Kathleen, you read some very, very interesting statistics. So why don't you give those to our listeners?
Well, most of the media coverage in the 2010 census will likely focus on the country's changing racial composition and redistribution seats in Congress. But rather, dramatic increases in the size of the U.S. population itself has been profoundly implications for our nation's quality of life and environment. Projections in the future of the Census Bureau show that we are on track to add 130 million more people over the next 40 years, primarily due to immigration. Immigration accounted for three-quarters of population growth through the decade. The Census Bureau data found that 13.1 million new immigrants, legal and illegal, who arrived in the last 10 years. That's a lot of people. Those were also about 8.2 million births to immigrant women during that decade. So immigration is really facing a huge impact on our census.
And I'm reading from a Fox News report entitled Illegal Immigrants Factor into 2010 Census Results. And it says in this news report, and I did not know this, that illegal immigrants are counted in the U.S. Census by law, and therefore they have an inevitable impact on the way House seats are divvied up. And a research director at the Anti-Immigration Center for Immigration Studies, whose director we've had, Mark Krikorian, has been a guest on this show, estimated the total number of illegal immigrants counted in the 2010 census at about 10 million. That is really a remarkable number. And I did not know that illegal aliens were by law counted in the census. And if you look at these places that have the states that have lost seats and the states that have gained seats, you see border states here. Texas, Florida is sort of a border state. Arizona, Nevada, and then Utah is close, are all gaining seats. And what's interesting about that, in addition to the border thing, all these places that are losing seats are places that are losing jobs, and the illegals are not only going to the border states, although clearly those are easier to go to, but these are all also states, with the exception of Nevada, that have relatively better unemployment than a lot of these other states that are being run into the ground by Democrats and their high taxes. But what's going to be very interesting, for example, Texas gains four seats, and you know, everybody thinks of Texas as this, you know, one of the reddest of red states.
Right.
But if it ends up being that the way these four seats, that these four seats include large numbers of Hispanics, and if Hispanics maintain their recent affinity to the Democratic Party, and you can bet that the Democrats are going to try to get them to do that by bringing up things like the Dream Act and trying to make Republicans look like they're anti-Hispanic, you know, you might not see all four of those seats be Republican. You might even see a 2-2 split. Who knows? And Florida picking up two seats, you know, Florida is it used to be a pretty conservative state, but it's been very borderline. We all remember Bush v. Gore, and
right.
then against John Kerry, it was fairly close as well. So, you know, those two could be one Democrat, one Republican. Who knows with Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, hard to say as well. And Washington, you know, fairly likely that that'll be a Democrat seat, actually.
Right.
What's interesting about that, though, you know, Washington is a state with no state income tax. So
right.
the only really serious Democrat state that picks up a seat is a state with no state income tax.
Well, it was an interesting point that Joshua brought up during the break, is that maybe the people that are moving from these blue states going to a red state because the economy might be better is indeed then just bringing their trail with them to become a blue pocket in a red state. And I think that's what you're saying here, is that by drawing those districts, they could make themselves that blue pocket in a red state, and that's not any better. That's not any better.
Even the New York Times are... Now, I do believe that the reapportionment of seats will help Republicans. It's definitely going to help Republicans. It's just a question of how much.
Well, the state legislatures around, we have gained so many, and we've also gained so many governorships that I think that we are in prime place. That I think that was the underscoring of the last election, is the importance for the census. And I don't think that was talked about enough, but I think that's one of the great things that happened out of the election, was that we are in a good position right now in 2010 for this reapportionment and for the redrawing of the districts. So.
Right. And the other thing to keep in mind is especially important for presidential elections, where the electoral votes don't go, aren't broken out by congressional district, but rather a whole state, all of those states' electoral votes go to the president.
Right.
So Texas, in the aggregate, remains very Republican.
Right, exactly.
And they will have four more electoral votes. So, you know, you can already see in the presidential race that this certainly helps Republicans. And as you were
Absolutely.
Talking about with the redistricting, you know, one of these sort of swing states is Pennsylvania. It's been fairly blue, but it's not impossible for Pennsylvania to go for a Republican.
Right.
And Republicans took over control of Pennsylvania. And for those of you who are really into the nuts and bolts of politics, one sort of slightly conservative, and I use that term very loosely when it comes to Democrats, but slightly conservative Democrat named Jason Altmaier in Pennsylvania. And then there's another district with a guy named Mark Kritz, which is the seat that was held by John Murtha
right.
before he died. And what's probably going to happen is the Republicans will redistrict, because Pennsylvania is losing a seat. They will redistrict in a way that put, and they're both Democrats, that will put Altmaier and Kritz in the same newly formed district, and they'll have to run against each other.
Right, so they've knocked each other out.
One of them will get knocked out, and then maybe and that seat in any case will be vulnerable to a Republican, and that's how this is going to go
yeah.
across the country. Because
yeah.
as you said, Republicans have, you know, putting aside the mess that was Colorado, Republicans have taken over, I think, 2/3 of.
I think 27 or more we picked up. I can't remember the number, but on election night, we were all here working real hard. And that was just a stunning to me as well. As the Census Bureau stated, its population projections in 2000, immigration is a highly ineffective means for addressing the problem of an aging society in the long run. Because we're talking, too, that not only are we dealing with just the influx of the immigration on the economy, but also in the population age. 13.1 immigrants who arrived in the last 10 years, plus all of their children that they've had, have reduced the average age in the United States slightly from 37.4 years old to 36.8 years old. And I'm not sure if that's good or bad. It's just the way that it is.
I'm sure it's good. Or at least not as bad as it would be otherwise. And we can talk about this more after the break, but if you think about what's going on in Europe
yeah.
with their aging populations and not enough workers to fund their massive bloated entitlement systems, it's a huge problem for them. And as you said, they're unskilled workers, but it's better than no workers. Anyway, we'll talk about that more when we come back after this break here on Backbone Radio. Stay with us on News Talk 710 KNUS and 1460 KZNT. We'll be back after these words.